Welcome to Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle. I'm Bobby Osinski, and this is a show all about music, music production, and the music business. My guest today is engineer-producer Garth Richardson. But first, let's talk about the Apple Music announcement. Apple announced their brand new music service this past week, although it was no surprise to anyone. The details might have been a surprise, but the actual announcement wasn't. Everybody kind of expected it, and we expected it way before last week, actually. There are four, or actually five, parts to Apple Music that make it very, very interesting. The first is the catalog is bigger than just about any other music service out there, and by about 10 million songs or 15 million songs. That being said, most people don't listen to those songs. Even though the catalog is huge, chances are most of the things that are available you don't much care about. It's been a fact that the majority of songs that are in the catalogs of these services are only listened to a handful of times. So maybe that's irrelevant. One thing that isn't irrelevant, though, is the fact that you can use Siri to actually call up songs. And that's kind of cool. So basically, you can ask for a song from Siri. You can ask for a song from a year, the number one song from a particular month in a particular year. You can use Siri to basically find your music. And no other service can actually say that. The next thing that really sets it apart is Beats One. And this is a 24/7 radio station. It's a worldwide radio station, and it may be the very first one of its kind. It originates from three different cities, from New York, LA, and London. The program director is someone out of the BBC who is noted for his good taste, and that's the one thing that will actually set it apart from any other radio station. What's interesting about this is there's no advertising, and it's like FM of old. And if any of you heard the old FM during the 70s, it was a thing of beauty where you tuned in primarily for the DJ and the taste of the DJ, knowing that there may be something that you've never heard before that he or she would play, but chances are you're going to like it. And we all hope that Beats One is like that. The other thing about Apple Music is the fact that the navigation looks pretty easy, and it looks not only easy to get to your music that you've already bought or already loaded into iTunes, but also it will curate your playlists and will give you suggestions looking at the songs that you like already and some basic information that you give it. So that being said, navigation is really important, and there are some music services that have better navigation than others. It looks like, without having used this, I can't say for sure, but it looks like Apple Music actually is fairly easy to use, and that will be a big plus. Perhaps one of the best features is something that hasn't been played up a lot, and that's the fact that there's a family plan available. Now, you've probably heard that it's $9.95 a month. Yes, that's true. There's a three-month trial period for free, and we'll talk a little bit about that in a second. But there's also a $14.99 family plan that's interesting because you can have up to six members of your family, and they each have their own accounts. And that basically means that the recommendations, the catalogs, the playlists are different for each account. So that's $14.99. That's a pretty good deal. And that might be enough to get a lot of people to actually sign on. Apple believes they're going to have 100 million subscribers in no time, primarily because they have 850 million credit cards on file in the iTunes store. That sounds like a lot, but what a lot of people don't realize is the fact that a lot of those, and I think the majority of them, are more for the App Store than they are for iTunes Music. So we'll see very, very shortly whether this 850 million credit cards actually is as big a deal as everyone thinks it is. Either way, I wouldn't be surprised if Apple got to 100 million customers within a year, two at the most. If that happens, that changes the music industry a great deal, primarily because there's a whole lot more money that's coming in every month on a regular basis. So that'll be interesting to see what happens. Now, the Apple Music announcement has gotten a lot of pushback, primarily because of the three-month trial period. What's happening is they're not paying artists for their streams, for their plays during that period. And artists feel like they're being taken advantage of. The fact of the matter is, though, Apple isn't getting paid because they're not selling advertising. So unlike some of the other services like Spotify or Pandora, on the free tier, they're selling advertising, so there's actually income coming in, and therefore they're sharing in that income. Now, because there's less income than on the paid tier, there's also a smaller royalty rate. In this case, there is no revenue being generated during that trial period, so that's why the artists are not getting, and the songwriters for that matter, are not getting paid. In fact, Apple is losing money on this trial period. One of the things that artists are upset about is they're not getting paid. However, it's a wash. No one is getting paid on this, including Apple. If Apple was smart, they would have paid the artists anyway because it probably won't be a huge amount of money and they have a lot of money anyway. It would have generated a lot of goodwill. But the fact of the matter is they're the 800-pound gorilla in town. They don't have to do anything. If you have any questions or comments, send them to questions at bobbyoinnercircle.com. Don't forget about my new coaching program. It's 101 Mixing Tricks, Big Studio Tricks for the Small Studio. Go to 101mixingtricks.com. That's 101mixingtricks.com to learn more. The next thing I want to talk about is Moog Music, the synthesizer manufacturer, has given the company to its employees. And this is really unusual. The CEO of the company, Michael Adams, has given 49% of the company right now to its employees, and the remaining 51% of the company will be given to them over the next 6 years. Now, there's some tax ramifications here that are advantageous to Michael Adams, and this is why he's doing it over a period of 6 years, but eventually, all of the employees there will actually have a piece of the company. Basically, what happens is it takes about 6 years to vest. So in other words, after the first year, then your piece of the company begins to vest at about 20% a year. What that means is if you start at minimum wage at Moog Music, by the time you're ready to retire, your stake in the company is worth about $100,000, which is pretty good. So hats off to Moog Music for giving the company to their employees. You don't see it very often, and it's really cool that it actually happens in the music business occasionally. My guest today is Garth Richardson, who grew up in the studio thanks to his dad, Jack Richardson, who produced Alice Cooper, The Guess Who, Badfinger, and Poco, among others. After being around music all his life, it's no surprise that Garth has gone on to engineer records for luminaries like Taylor Swift, Red Hot Chili Peppers, Nickelback, and Motley Crue, and to produce acts like Rage Against the Machine and Mudvayne. He's also one of the founders of the excellent Nimbus Recording School, along with producer Bob Ezrin. I spoke with Garth from the studio in Vancouver via Skype. Garth, thank you for being with me today.
Yeah, it's great.
Pleasure and an honor.
Well, thank you. Thank you.
I want to go back to the beginning here. What was it like growing up in the studio with a father that was a famous record producer?
I would say it was actually kind of really cool, but then yet there was this father figure that when he was in the inside of the studio, he was God. He was this bigger than life man. But then at home, he was like, Dad, you know what? And I kept telling him to, when I was getting older, I'd go, you know, Dad, fuck off. And you know what? He'd look at me. And then after I got into the business and then I began doing things and then I called him up and go, hey, Dad, you remember when I used to tell you to, you know, like, so shove it. You know, Dad, I'm sorry. He says, I know you are. But you know what? You had to learn it. And I used to watch him do with a Guess Who, Alice Cooper, got to watch him, you know, like do all of his amazing bands. But then at home, he was a dad, you know, totally amazingly cool.
Did he go out of his way to teach you anything, or was it just by osmosis for, you know, being around?
The one thing he was always actually teaching, the bands, us, his actual staff, he would always make sure that you understood everything.
So how did you get started out on your own then?
Actually, a guy named Michael Wagner, who, you know, did Accept, Extreme, like all these amazing, like big heavy metal bands. And he came up to actually phase one and, you know what, him and I got along great. He said, look, come down
to Whippisi, California. And I went, sure, yeah, sure, Michael, great, 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 great. You know, about 7 to 8 weeks later, the phone rang and he said, come on down. And I went down there for 6 weeks, which turned into 12 years. I never used a single contact from my dad because I had to do this on my own. I didn't want to go, I'm his son. I wanted them to go, oh, that's actually Jack's son, you know?
Yeah.
You know, so I really basically had to show the people that I did have a clue.
So you didn't tell anybody that you were Jack's son. You were trying to be anonymous.
Exactly. Yeah.
That's cool. That's cool that you did that.
Yeah. Yeah.
How old were you when all this happened?
I was about 25.
It's kind of late.
Well, yeah, but you know what? It actually started when I was actually 15 years old. I used to hang out in my dad's studio. And my first gig that I did for my dad happened to be Bob Seger Night Moves.
Wow.
So I was this kid and the band had left and Bob hated this one song. My dad said, look at Bob, you know, just let me hear some more songs. And he began to play Night Moves. And my dad said, that's a hit. The next day, they brought in all these cats and they went, okay, Garth, let's go. You got to plug in the drum mics. You got to plug in all the stuff. Let's, you know, I was like, I'm in, you know. So I literally started when I was actually 15 years old. It took me 8 years to finally get a job because my dad's name was so big.
Well, let's skip ahead to now. I'm curious, how much do you do in the box? Because you're kind of a vintage classic guy, right?
You mean, you mean I'm old?
No. No.
Basically, it all depends on the budgets now, right? Because if you have a big budget, I did the last three Biffy Clyro records, and we did everything out of drums on tape. Because one, we had the money. But I do everything in the box because that's basically the norm now, you know, because one, finding, two things, finding a band that can play.
Not easy. And
also, yeah. And also finding a tape machine that can work.
Yeah.
The funny story is I get these young bands and they go, Garth, we really want to make an old school record. Great, guys. Let me hear you play. And they play one song and say, you know, guys, just let me hear one more song. And then after the second song, it goes, so you really want to make a really old score? And they go, yeah, we do. I go, great. You're fired. You're fired. You're fired. And you're fired. And they go, what do you mean? I go, that's how they used to do it. If you couldn't play, you'd be sitting in. And you know what? You have to realize that every old school room always had that beautiful sofa sitting in front of the console.
Yeah.
That was where the band used to sit while watching the actual players play. You know, so now anybody can kind of play. You can actually fix it. You can make it sound like they can play, which is sad.
You know, one of the big problems, I don't know if it's like this in Canada, but I suspect it is. In the U.S., the club scene has pretty much gone away. And it all started when the first DUI laws came in. In 1983. Oh, it's really true because all of a sudden, it made everybody, and then they raised the drinking age from 18 to 21 and the club scene went away and it's only gotten worse since then. So there's no, you know, place to go out and play as a band and get good together.
You know what? Yeah. There's a very funny, basic conversation. My really good friend, Randy Staub, who did Metallica, he did Rattle and Hum. You know, he's like done a bunch of records. And he was one of the many that was asked to mix the last Van Halen record. And he got into this amazing conversation with actually David Lee Roth. The other problem is these new bands have never been in a actual cover band.
Yeah, right.
Right. And the reason why all these amazing bands that we love and have hit song after hit song after hit song, because they understood what a hit song was prior to them writing their songs. The bands now, you can say, have you heard of this artist or this artist or this artist or this song or this song? And they'll go, nope. No, nobody going, how are you going to become great if you don't know where everything that was actually great came from? So I think that's another problem too.
I never considered that, but you're right. Yeah.
You know what? It boils down to the fact that there aren't any clubs that play in. The bands feel that they don't have to learn covers because their songs that they write are, you know, amazingly great, which they're not. You know, yeah. So you know, there's this whole thing that has to be fixed.
You know, a lot of it too, when you're playing cover songs, it's a rite of passage for one thing, but you know, the other thing is it gives you the skills to arrange because you learn the rules of arrangement, because all hits have a great arrangement.
Oh yeah, yeah. You know what? And you understand what a lead line is or a actual great chorus.
Yeah.
You know, and you know what? So many people, I say, just take that one line and just say it over and over again. They go, oh, that's boring. I go, yeah, she loves you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you. Yeah, yeah, yeah. She loves you. Yeah, 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 yeah. It's like, that's really boring. But that was one of the biggest songs of our time.
Yeah.
You know, so you know what? It's sad because, you know what? I find everyone is getting lazy because of our new modern and natural technology. Nobody has to get off the couch and actually learn to play.
Yeah. Oh, you're right. You're right. You know, in some ways, though, I think musicianship is better than others. And I'll tell you, especially with a click, because kids grow up today learning how to play with loops and a click.
Yeah.
So if anything, that's one thing that they're better at than we were when we first started, because everybody had a problem for the most part. You know, I remember.
Yeah. My dad, the funny thing was my dad had an old RE15. Mike.
Yeah.
And he had an H2B pencil, and he would have it underneath the actual arm of the board, and he'd be keeping time. And when the band began to speed up, he would speed up with them, but he would then bring them back a little bit so that they wouldn't rush too much. And that was how they would do it in the old days. So it was rare that you could play to a click, but my father figured out how to be able to move the band.
That's very cool.
Yeah. So you know, the great thing about the old days is that we figured out how to do things.
Yeah.
You know, now it's Apple S, Apple V, Apple C. You know, it's just you know, copy paste, fixed, done.
A friend of mine who's our age and came up the same way and is used to working on a console and real studios, and he's had a lot of Grammys, more than 10. Let's put it like that.
Wow.
Is working with a very famous artist, and I don't want to say who it is because it will give it away.
Yep.
But a very famous pop artist, and the producers are young. They're in their early 20s. So he said that they're going to do vocals, and he set up a nice C12 into an old 1081 and into an LA2 and a really nice signal chain and everything. And the producer came in, and she said, okay, put it on track 23. What's your template? And he said, well, what do you mean template? And she said, well, every engineer has a template, and I like to see what they're using. He said, well, here's my template. And he shows the C12. He points to the C12 and the preamp and the compressor. He says, no, okay, let's bring my template up. And here what it was, there was 5 plugins in the signal chain.
Yeah.
And never changed anything, and he said that it just sounded so bad that he wasn't sure if it was the mic, if there was something distorting, and only later, after everyone left, he was able to bypass it and go, oh, yeah, okay, it does sound good, you know, at some point. But that's the whole thing, where they start with, you know, a template with all sorts of plugins, and, geez, we never did that, anything like that.
Well, I was working with his band, and I won't say the name either, but the singer, when he sang a line, you couldn't play it back to him unless it was tuned. So you would sing it, and then you'd hit the auto on it and correct it and play back and go, okay, that's good. Okay, that's fine. Next. And he had his own engineer to do his vocals. And I got the vocals, you know, given to me to actually put into the track. And after the first song, I said, stop. This is not going to work. This is horrible. So there's this whole methodology of that you don't have to work hard.
Yeah.
You know, the thing that you know and I know, and I'm sure your friend knows this, making records is not easy. It's hard work.
Yeah.
You know, it's mentally and it's actually physically, because you have to focus so hard on everything. You have to make sure that your mic is the right, your compressor is working, your mic pre is great. You can make sure that the artist can sing. You got to make sure that everything is right. Nowadays, it's, you know, as you say, she comes in with her template and you're like going, what the fuck is this?
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
It's sad.
Can you, when you produce something, do you engineer as well? Can you do both?
I can. I find nowadays that, you know, and of course I came up in the old school days to where, you know, I've always had a engineer up there all the time and also produce, but it's such a lot of work got to do that one role that you have to do everything. You know, spending time with my actual singer is the most important part of anyone's record. The drums are great, the guitars are fantastic, but you have to make sure that your singer is the bomb. If he's not, then you're done.
Yeah.
You know. So I do engineer, but I do have a great guy named actually Ben Kaplan, and he's been with me now for actually ready 15 years.
Oh, wow. Very cool.
You know, so it's like, I mean, I don't even have to talk. It's like, he knows what I want. He knows what he needs to do, and it gets done.
For me, it's a budget thing. If there's enough money, I'll engineer the overdubs, but... Yeah. As far as tracking, I always want to have somebody else if I can. But, you know, I've had some things where I've done both and it gets done. But, you know, you can't concentrate on one thing. And that's the problem. You're going back and forth mentally.
And then if you have to deal with something that's happening in the band dynamics, then you have to focus on that.
Yeah.
Because if that falls apart, it doesn't matter, you know, on the knobs on the console, because you have a band that's doing this, you know, when they're fighting, you know, and you have to deal with that. So I like to be able to leave, come back in with actually fresh ears and hear what is being done, saying this is what you need to do. And then I'm going to go and deal with the lyrics and the writing and the melodies of the songs and that kind of stuff. So,
yeah. Ken Scott told me an interesting story because he always engineers and produces everything. He said that he was starting an album with Cat Stevens.
Wow.
And they went all over the world to try to find the perfect studio with the right vibe and everything. And they wound up in Amsterdam. And during the first basic that they were doing, the first day in the studio, something happened with the tape machine. It was playing at the wrong speed. And there was a language problem. So Ken kept on concentrating on that, trying to work that out. In the meantime, Kat got very upset about the whole thing, about being ignored. And basically walked out, and it was the end of the session, and Ken never worked with them after that. And he said it taught him a lesson that, you know, no matter what's happening in the control room, you still have to make the artist the priority.
Well, that, you know what, that's the one thing that my father taught me was, you are dealing with human beings. You know what, the machines can fall apart and you can fix them, but if your artist falls apart, then you're going to spend a lot more time trying to get that back.
Yeah.
That's an amazing story, because we all basically forget that, you know, because we are so concentrated on this spec and that spec and this and that spec and that stuff. It's about dealing with human beings. It's a, you know, feelings, heart and soul, you know.
And that's part of a producer's job, a big part, being the diplomat.
Yeah.
Tell me about your studio, The Farm. It used to be Little Mountain, right?
Yeah. Basically, I had the opportunity of actually taking over Little Mountain Studio B, and it's like walking back into like 1979, 80, and the walls haven't changed. The actual cloth on the walls is, you know, all beginning to basically fall apart, but there's this vibe and there's a sound there that is like, you know, old school. The records that were made there, Dr. Feelgood by Motley Crue.
Yeah.
Pump, Get a Grip, part of the Metallica Black album was done there. David Lee Roth, Coverdale Page, you know, the list goes on and on and on and on and on. And it's just a great, solid room, you know, and you know what? I'm actually lucky enough out of habit, because you know what? It really makes your job simple, because the room sounds good. The reason why the room sounded so good was because one of the board, but that room for some strange reason worked. And you would literally put in the kick drum mic, push up the fader, and you go, okay, bass drum sound, next.
Yeah.
Push up the fader, snare sound, okay, next. you know, and that's kind of the same way that's actually had this room too. It's just, it was just built well.
People can't understand that the studio can add so much.
Yeah.
And just
yeah.
The sound of the room can make a huge difference. And in this day where we all have our own home studios and most people have something, it's hard for them to get their arms around it if they've never been in a studio like that. There's no reference point.
Exactly. Yeah. Because you know what? We got four major rooms, actually, Vancouver. We have actually, Mushroom is now back again.
Oh, no kidding.
Which is great. We have the Armory. We have the warehouse, and then we have my place, and each room sounds different.
Yeah.
So depending on the band that you're doing, you kind of go, I want to go to the Armory because it's very bright and ambient and it's live. You want to go to the warehouse, it's very dark and it's all brick. And then you want to go to Mushroom where it's a big concrete box and it has a high ceiling and it has actually drapes up and it has a great sound. You know, so the thing that these young kids need to understand that a small boxy room is going to sound like a small boxy room.
Yeah, right.
You know, you know what? No matter what you do to it, it's going to sound like it's a box.
Yeah, you know? I get these emails all the time because I wrote a book on acoustics or on building your own studio. So I get these emails and it starts like, okay, I have a bedroom and it's 12 by 12 and the ceilings are 10 foot high and I want to isolate it so nobody hears me and I want it to sound good. And it's like, oh man, you are starting it though. Talk about the worst possible scenario. And this happens more than, you know, I'd like it to happen. But, you know, then again, you have to look at it from the other standpoint where it's like, well, hey, good for you for putting it together, for trying to put something together and for trying to do it as good as you can.
Yeah. Yeah. But they have to realize that people spend, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars making a room sound good.
Yeah.
That's just the way it is.
You also own a rehearsal studio, the Vancouver Rackspace, right? Rackspace.
Rackspace, yeah. Yeah. Now that used to be Little Mountain Studio A. And the good news is the people that first turned it into the Rackspace, they built three basically rooms inside of the live room, but never touched the live room.
Interesting.
So they put another room inside of the control room and they never touched it. So probably within like another year and a half to two years, our school, Nimbus School of Recording Arts and Media, is going to rip out those three rooms in the live room and restore Little Mountain A.
That's awesome. I saw there was a Ward Beck in the control room. Was that the original console?
You know what? That's a console that I'm going to be bringing up here to my farm because that is Canada's answer to the Neve.
Yeah, right. But it's been broadcast way back when, right?
Yeah, but you know what they did? And nobody knows this. Basically, because it was made for the CBC, it had to be made to BBC standards.
Oh, yeah, right.
And the guy that I met who actually helped design that actual console, he told me that they double wrap the actual power transformers and all the transformers on each channel. So it's a Class A console. It's probably the beefiest, richest, warmest thing that I have ever used. And it actually sounds better than a Neve.
Wow.
And people are like, well, Ward Beck, what's that? It doesn't look like a Neve. But you know what, guys? It sounds as good as or actually better than a Neve. And you can actually find these consoles around for like $3,000.
Yeah, right. Because again, they're broadcast and people didn't understand.
People hear the word broadcast, they're going, well, that's not rock and roll. But it's, you know what? It's guys, use your ears. Don't use your eyes.
Yeah.
You know what? I have a saying now because so many kids and so many people are always looking at the screen, pointing at the waveform, going, that doesn't look right. I go, well, how's it sound?
Yeah.
I don't know. And I'm going, don't be an engine eye, be a engineer.
I love it.
Don't use your eyes, use your ears, because you know what? That was how we used to do it, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We used to not look at a monitor. Yeah. We would listen, you know?
That's right. Look at the meters sometimes. But I remember doing a session with Roy Thomas Baker.
I'm just, sorry.
And
you know what? He's an absolute madman, but a genius. I love Roy.
That's the story, basically. And he got his drum sound up, and when the drummer started running it down, all the meters pegged. they just went up and they didn't come back down. but that was part of his sound. He knew how to drive things just to the point where, you know, it sounded good. It sounded aggressive, and he knew when to stop.
Well, another great Roy Thomas Baker story was when he mixed, he used to set up a bar, a fully stocked bar in the lounge. And so by the time he would call the band in to listen to the mix, they were so hammered that they go, great, we love it. They go, great, thanks, guys. So he used to purposely get them drunk so that when they came in, he didn't have to fight with them. You know, he's probably one of our greatest guys to have ever made actually music. Yeah. You know? Yeah. He's absolutely phenomenal, you know, and, you know, just a gentleman.
Yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. You know, you mentioned Nimbus before. I want to go there. Yes. How did Nimbus recording come around? I got to tell you, I was so impressed that I've still been telling people about it, anybody that will listen, because I just thought it was very innovative what you guys are doing, how you're putting it all together. It was great. How did Nimbus Recording School come about?
Okay, well, basically about when I moved back up from California and I began to work in other actual studios here in town, within the first 5 years, I had fired or I had had these so-called new kids coming into our business fired. And it was about a total of about 45 kids. Let me just tell you this. This is probably the best story ever. Mr. Chris Shaw was my engineer mixing for me. He did the last two Dylan records, Super Furry Animals, you know, like his actual record is amazing. And he gets very kind of intense when he mixes. And he turns to our runner and goes, I just want some soup. So the runner goes out, comes back, and it's in a basic plastic bag. And it's in that one of the styrofoam cups. Yeah. But the kid dropped the bag of soup and handed it to Chris Shaw. And there's pieces of styrofoam floating in his soup. And Chris gets it and holds it and looks at the soup. And I'm off in the corner and I look over and I get up and I go up to this kid and I go, how fucking dare you? Your job is so simple to bring him soup properly. And if you can't do that, how are we going to let you in this room? And I said, this is an insult to him because your job is simple. Bring him soup.
Yeah.
And you basically drop it. Don't bother to think about going back and getting a new one and giving him the soup that he asked for, right? So these were the kind of kids that were coming out of school that weren't being taught how to become a actual proper human being.
Yeah.
So Bob Ezrin and I, about 9 years ago, I said, Bob, I've just fired another second engineer or another intern or a runner or whatever you want to call them. And dude, we are heading down a slope of where we are going to be having to deal with these poor kids that know nothing. And we're going to have to train them, but it's going to take us twice as long. So we said, why don't we open up our own school? Because clearly these schools don't actually teach, because they always hire the best student that goes at the front door and he comes in the back door here. And so he has been taught by somebody that's been taught by somebody that's been taught by somebody that's been taught by somebody that has never made a single record in their lives.
Yeah.
It'd be the same thing as me going up to battle. And if that teacher was my actual guy, take me over the hill, yell to fight, I would shoot him first. Because he has no clue, right? He is completely clueless, right? So Bob and I, about 9 years ago, said, we need to do this. And we opened up the school because my father taught Bob. Bob taught me. But then Bob, because my father beat the shit out of Bob. And then, of course, Bob went, I'm going to get back at Jack and I'm going to get with son. So Bob beat the crap out of me, too. But we learned properly. So we literally opened up a school, but we made it so that it's 8 kids per class, because more than 8 kids in a class, you cannot teach.
Yeah.
And we also have the actual clinical psychologist in the school, too.
Yes, I met her, actually.
Yeah. Because for everything that Ivor did wrong, I wish that I had her. Because, you know, well, I didn't know how to deal with people.
Yeah.
So our mandate is to show them how the gear works, to show them how to do it properly, but to also turn them into decent human beings so that they can function.
Right. I mean, the other thing you're doing is you're teaching them how to be entrepreneurs.
Yes.
Because that's what you are in the music business. You're an entrepreneur. Yeah. And most, especially universities are like this. Their whole concentration is on getting a job and job placement. That's it. But we don't get jobs in the music business. We make our own.
The actual funny thing is back when I started back in 81 or 80 to get a job, there weren't any jobs back then.
Yeah.
You know, and it's the same thing. No, there aren't any jobs. No, you make your own work. You get out there and you meet bands. You say, hey, man, I want to produce your band.
Yeah.
You know, I want to engineer your band. I want to help you with, you know, your stuff. And that's how it is. It isn't that somebody, you go and say, we are looking for 75 record producers this month at our office. You know, it just doesn't happen.
Yeah, right.
So you're turning them into entrepreneurs. And with great skills.
You know, you're doing it really well, and that's one of the finest schools from what I've seen.
Great. Thank you very much.
Congratulations on that.
Thank you.
Just change subjects for a little bit. I noticed Taylor Swift is on your resume.
Yes.
Which seems a little out of place. Considering some of the other acts you've worked with, how did that come about?
The funny thing, the funny thing is, and I'll get to Taylor Swift in a second, but you know how many times, you know, that people call me and say, you know, hey, we'd like you to do this record. We know that you like metal, or you only do hard rock. I'm going, no, I do all kinds of stuff. It just happens that I actually had some really big, huge records doing metal. So, of course, everybody pigeonholes me into that.
Yeah.
The whole thing happened with actually Taylor Swift was that Bob was doing her actual live record, and he came up out of Vancouver and says, Garth, I got out of class here at the school. Would you mind going through and fixing this and this and this and this and this on the record? So I said, sure, I'll do it. And I did it. And then he came in and listened to it. Great. Done. Moved on. So it just happened to actually happen that way.
Yeah.
You know what? Never met her. I'm sure she's a great, you know, but, you know, small tale, you know, but it worked.
I've done a bunch of that, too. I did 5-1 mixes on Who records for DVDs, the Who and the Ramones and people like that.
Yeah.
And they were never there when I was doing it. It was the same thing.
Yeah.
What's your favorite signal chain? And I ask you this because I know now that you're working a lot in the box. So
the funny thing is every time that we basically record, we don't use anything in the box. We use all outboard gear and all outboard mic pre's.
Yeah.
When it comes time to mixing, because the problem is nowadays is that when you do a mix on a console, the band would be there with you because of the budget. Now they're all over the world. And you know what? The funny thing is we used to have to get the mix done, make sure that we got it to actually FedEx by 5 o'clock to send to the band. We would leave the mix up overnight, go out, have dinner, get drunk, you know, go to the clubs. The next day we get the call at about 10 o'clock because that's about the time they got it. They would all be in a room and they listen to it and they go, okay, we need blah, 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 change it. We would change it. It'd be done. Which is great.
Yeah.
But now you can send it to them via the internet. And you now get this, hey, man, you know, I'm actually heading out to go to a movie with my lady. I can't listen to the mix until maybe tonight late or first thing in the morning, you know, and you're there going, oh, for fuck's sakes. So the great thing about doing everything in the box mixing wise is that you can instantly recall it. Because you get the guy going, I think the hi-hat in the second verse needs to come up, 0.3 dB. And you're there going, what does 0.3 dB mean?
Yeah, right. Like everybody's going to hear it, right?
Yeah. Can you hear 0.3 dB? No, you cannot. So we are still purists when it comes to recording. We use Pro Tools as our actual tape machine.
Yeah.
But when it comes time to mixing, we have to mix in the box because – one, to have to recall a basically 122 channel console every time you want to raise up the actual hi-hat, and the chances of you getting it back exactly the way that it was is hard.
Yeah, right.
You know, but a really funny story, I met a friend of mine come to me, wanted me to hear his mix. And I opened up his session, and he had his actual vocal chain, and he had every single plug-in port used. Then he had it going through a bus with another four basic plugins. But this is how he was on almost every channel of the whole mix.
Wow.
And I hit play and I went, oh my God. And I stopped. I said, you know what? Let me save as. And I took off every single plugin.
Yeah.
And hit play. And he goes, that sounds better. Yeah. And like I'm going, you know, just because it's there doesn't mean that you have to use it. Andy Wallace has mixed, I don't know, countless hit records.
Yeah.
And when I first actually worked with him, I came in and I said, so Andy, what do you use outboard gear wise? He says, nothing.
Just the console, yeah.
He just used the console. So he has one EQ and one gate and one compressor.
Yeah.
So I then turned to my friend. I said, here is what I want you to do. You get one EQ, one compressor per channel, period, mix.
Yeah.
And he came back and said, man, I have never heard it sound better than this. So I'm still a absolute purist when it comes to getting your sounds going into the box.
Yeah.
But we are now all being forced to have to mix in the box, because if you have to recall, you really have to recall fast. But we still use outboard gear on certain things because it still sounds better. Basically, which I always tell these young bands, an 1176 plugin is like cyber sex. A real 1176 is like getting a real blowout.
Yeah, yeah.
There's the whole difference. I'm actually mixing this record now, and I'm mixing it in the box, but I do have it coming up on my console, and I'm reaching for the SSL inside the box plugin, and I'm turning the EQ, and it's like I'm going, I can stop, and I go over to the real EQ, and I turn the same knob, and the absolute drastic difference of what a real EQ sounds like compared to this fake EQ sounds like. I'm sure it's doing math, but it doesn't sound the same.
Yeah.
It's not close. And all these people are saying it sounds the same, because they have to say that, because if they spent the time that we used to spend recalling mixes and getting them right, you'd be mixing someone's record for 3 months.
Yeah.
So I do love the whole new modern technology. I think it's great, because back in the days, I used to have to fly background vocals, putting them on 2 half-inch tape,
yeah,
finding my mark, and every time go 1, 2, 3, and then hit play and go, nope, a little bit behind. So let me move my tape, and I hit it at the exact same spot. And that's how we used to fly in the vocals.
Yeah.
Now it's Apple C, go to the grid, Apple V, it's done, and you're like, you know, great. So, wonderful now, but it's actually some romance lost, I find.
Yeah, I think it's the same thing with mixing. When the days before automation, when you had 4 sets of hands on, and it was a performance that you're doing, you didn't get perfect mixes, but boy, there was a vibe, because there's so much going on, and it was very subtle, and now, of course, we don't have that. I was talking to a friend of mine who's a great mixer and has mixed a lot of hits, and he was saying that the fact that we can automate so much today that mixes kind of have to be perfect, and people expect them to be perfect, and you know, you can automate that one word if you want, or the one syllable, and to do whatever, and the expectations of listeners have changed, which makes the expectations of the artists change.
Right, right. But you know what? The one thing that everybody lacks, and I actually told this story time and time again, because when I was literally 15, 16, I said, Dad, I want to follow you in your footsteps. He says, okay, son, we got to have a talk. And I had a pad of paper and I had a pen, and I was waiting for this 3-hour dissertation. I'm sure he's a gold actually plated mic cables and gold plated, you know, this, and you know, you had to make sure that, you know, the cables all had to match exact, you know, like I was waiting for this sure thing. And he comes in the room, says, okay, ready? Yep. And I have my pad of paper and I'm ready to go. And he goes, good songs sell, bad songs don't.
I love it. Yeah.
And then he gets up and he leaves. And I go, that's it. He says, that's it. You know, so the problem is that we are now so obsessed about making everything perfect, but we are losing the fact of what it takes to write a great hit song. The problem that I have with actually radio today and what is now the hits, and the reason why was it actually Sam Smith and who's the blonde-headed kid that just goes up on stage and plays
I know what you mean.
You know, right. The reason why they're great because they aren't actually technically amazing, but they write great songs.
Yeah, right.
And then when you turn on radio or you turn on Much Music or MTV and you listen to these things that they say is actually music, it's the same formula, it's the same process, it's the same structure, it's everything, everything's about it the same. There's no originality because the labels are actually forced to put the same, you know what it's like? It's like Ford making the same car every year and they don't change a thing.
Yeah, I saw a statistic that was very interesting, and someone had looked at the last 50 years of hit songs, and they found out that there are fewer, like, one-hit wonders now. And the reason why is radio tends to stay with the hits a lot longer than they ever did, mostly because they're afraid of changing too often, so they don't alienate listeners. So they'll stay longer with the hit. And because of that, there are fewer songs making it into the top 40 or top 10, whatever it might be, top 20. Yeah. And therefore, there are fewer one-hit wonders than we used to have.
Yeah. And of course, when you look at Nickelback, love them and they're dear friends. But Chad has found a basic formula that every song they does, it's the exact same thing. And that's the reason why they've sold 90 or 80 million records. But after you've heard one record, you're kind of going, well, it's the same shit. You know, you have to look at the Beatles. They changed through their whole career. And you have to look at Radiohead, which is a new modern band. They haven't made the same record twice.
Yeah, that's right.
And I love that. Yeah. I love when a band does something different every time because you know what? You imagine having the same actually picture or the same painting in every room of your house.
Right, yeah.
Right? Yeah. You walk into, oh, that's the same picture you have in the other room. Yep. Because that's but that's exactly what our music business has become because the labels are now forced because there isn't as much money now. They have to do the same thing every time.
Yeah, me either. Last question for you.
Okay.
Maybe you just answered it. What's the best piece of business advice that you've ever received or you learned?
Wow. That's a great question. You know what? Actually, twofold question there. One is the best business advice that I ever got was to get a really good lawyer. Okay. And the other advice or the best piece of advice that I ever learned, and this goes out to all of you guys that are beginning to get into making records. As soon as you sense something is wrong with your session, with your singer, your drummer, your guitar, your guitar player, deal with it as soon as it happens. Because what happens is if you don't, it's almost like a dike. When that first crack happens, if you don't fix it, it's going to become a big crack and then the whole dike is going to fall down.
Yeah.
And that was whenever something happens right then and there, I deal with it right on the spot. I deal with it very nicely saying, I hear that you are having a hard time with this. How can I help you? And then all of a sudden, they're like, oh, yeah. You know, I said, you know what? It's not really that big of a deal. You deal with it. And then the singer or the drummer or whoever else is there, they're like, oh, that was easy.
Yeah.
And then the thing moves on. So the biggest thing is communication, I think.
Great advice.
Yeah. Good.
Garth, thank you so much for your time today. This was awesome.
Wonderful.
Thank you. Really enjoy talking to you. So thanks very much.
Okay, man.
To find out more about Garth, go to garth.com, and that's G-G-G-A-R-T-H. So it's garth.com, G-G-G-A-R-T-H, and you can find out a lot more about Garth Richardson. And if you want to find out about Nimbus Recording School, which is very cool, go to nimbusrecording.com. That's N-I-M-B-U-S, recording, all one word, .com. Thanks for listening and being in my inner circle. Remember, if you have any questions or comments, send them to questions@bobbyoinnercircle.com. Many thanks to Steve Cherubino. He's the host of the EDM Producer Podcast at edmmr.com. He helps put this show together. Thank you very much, Steve. To listen to other episodes of Bobby Osinski's Inner Circle, go to bobbyosinski.com and select the podcast tab, or go to bobbyoinnercircle.com, or you can find it on iTunes or Stitcher. At bobbyosinski.com and bobbyoinnercircle.com, you'll find a sign-up form for my newsletter for alerts for new podcasts. This is Bobby Osinski. I will see you next time.